Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Although one of the most successful film series in history, not many moviegoers and even fewer film critics have taken the James Bond films seriously. Our guest today thinks that might be a mistake. In a moment, we'll talk to James Chapman, author of License to Thrill, A Cultural History of the James Bond Films. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week, in 1776, Tom Paine published Common Sense, one of the most influential publications in American history. Paine, born in England, came to America in 1774. With a letter of introduction from Benjamin Franklin, who was then living in London, he got a job with the Pennsylvania Magazine in Philadelphia, where he was able to witness firsthand the debates surrounding the move toward American independence. In January 1776, stirred by those debates and frustrated by the reluctance of some to declare independence, Paine wrote Common Sense. He argued that the difficulties between England and her colonies could not be resolved by submission to authority, and that common sense dictated that independence was the only recourse. Paine's pamphlet appealed to colonial resentment at British treatment of the colonies, as well as the glory he believed possible if the colonies were to form a new nation. He wrote in a forceful, simple style that the average colonist could easily understand, and it was so widely read and quoted that many historians consider Common Sense as important to the independence movement as the Declaration of Independence. 12 months later, in December 1776, at the lowest point in the war for American independence, Paine published his even more famous tract, Crisis Paper No. 1, which opened with the well-known line, "These are the times that try men's souls." Turning to items of historical interest in the news, picking up on the subject of our interview today, a Canadian state secret is now public. The Ottawa Citizen recently reported on the existence of a spy museum in that city. The Canadian Security Intelligence Service has confirmed its existence, but is not inviting any visitors yet. As one agent put it, trying to play down any anticipation of a public museum, it's really just a set of showcases tucked away in a windowless vault of the agency's headquarters. Even if the items on display were declassified, he continued, the complex is closed to the public. Another report, however, notes that the museum is developing an exhibit designed to highlight the service's rich technological heritage and protect its many rare and unique artifacts, like bugging devices, surveillance equipment, and transmitters used by covert operatives. From Cold War-era tape recorders and specialized cameras to tradecraft items, an intelligence service newsletter explains, the museum will offer a rare glimpse into the past and provide hints at today's modern capability. The exhibit reminds us of Q, the unflappable genius of British intelligence who outfitted Agent 007, James Bond, for his cinematic adventures. But more on that in a moment. This is Talking History. We now move from Ottawa to London, from real spies to the best-known spy in movie history, James Bond. Here to explore that subject is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
James Bond made his cinematic debut in 1962. In all, he has appeared in 20 movies, which probably comprise the most successful film series in history. It's estimated that one quarter of the world's population has seen a Bond film. According to James Chapman, this suggests that the movies merit serious scholarly attention, attention he has given them in his recent book, License to Thrill, A Cultural History of the James Bond Films. Dr. Chapman, welcome.
Hello.
You're a scholar who also admits to being a James Bond aficionado. I wonder, how and when were you introduced to James Bond?
It goes back, I think, to my childhood when, they say, you often remember the first movie you ever see in a cinema on a big screen. And for me, this was a Bond movie in 1977, a family holiday. My parents took me to see The Spy Who Loved Me. And I think in retrospect, that's my fascination with James Bond goes back to that evening. I've been hooked on the movies ever since.
You were born, I think, in 1968,
mm-hmm.
by which time Sean Connery had already saved the world several times over from Dr. No and Goldfinger and other villains. How was it like then to go back as an aficionado or a scholar and see the 60s Bond movies long after they had been made?
It's very interesting because when I was sort of a boy and growing up and I was seeing Bond films in the 70s and 80s in the cinema, but then I was seeing the earlier films that were made in the 60s on television. And they were a sort of Christmas ritual showing a Bond film on British TV. But it's because I saw them all out of sequence. And it was only when I started really, I think, looking back at them as a historian and I watched the films through in sequence, in chronological order, that one gets a sense not only of the sort of development of the films in generic terms, but also of the really, what was really quite new and innovative about the early films in the series, Dr. No, From Russia with Love, Goldfinger. They were really, in the context of other films being made at that time, something quite fresh, something quite new, really quite original in popular cinema. The later films, which I grew up with in the cinema, are perhaps more, we're more familiar now with the conventions, they're more standardized perhaps. But the early films, certainly, I think, are quite a revelation if you can view them in context in relation to what had gone before.
Now you're writing a book about the movies, specifically. One of the questions that the aficionados often discussed is who's the best Bond on screen, usually Sean Connery or Roger Moore. You sidestep that question and suggest that the definitive Bond is Ian Fleming's Bond, the original Bond of the books. Why is that?
I think I use this term definitive as in the defining James Bond. I think we do have to go back to the original creation, to the original, the author's intention, and the character which does appear in print in Fleming's books in the 50s and early 60s. An analogy, I think, would be to a character like Sherlock Holmes, who like James Bond, has had a sort of long cultural history, constantly been reinvented, stories by other authors, played by many, many actors. But if you want to go back to the essence of Sherlock Holmes, we go back to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories. It's a similar way with James Bond. This also is my way of getting out of the sort of who was the best actor Bond by saying, well, all the actors who played James Bond are interpreting Ian Fleming's character. And maybe we shouldn't say that one interpretation is better than another or has more worth than another, but simply that they're different. All the actors who played Bond have got a slightly different interpretation to the character. There are certain essential characteristics that have to be there, the sort of gentleman spy, the sense of patriotism and duty and so on. So there's limited scope for really changing the character, but there are, I think, subtle differentiations in the way in which Connery plays Bond, Roger Moore, Dalton and Brosnan more recently.
I had forgotten about it until I read it in your book, that actually the first Bond on screen was not one of the ones we've named already, but an Americanized Bond for American television in the early 50s.
Yeah, back in 1954, before Bond had really taken off as a cultural icon, there was an American television adaptation, a live TV dramatization of Fleming's first novel, Casino Royale, which starred an American actor, Barry Nelson, a sort of Broadway stage actor, best known as a stage actor, as a character who's referred to as Jimmy Bond in the telecast. It's quite interesting that one of the, I think, ideological factors in Fleming's books was, I mean, this was a period of British decline, of the withdrawal, the retreat from empire, decline in Britain's world power. And I think one of the things which Fleming's books are trying to do was to reverse that. So, I mean, you know, the British hero always used to have an American sidekick in the form of Felix Leiter of the CIA. This American TV adaptation, I think, reverses this trend by making Bond an American, but his sidekick, Leiter, becomes a Britisher, symbolically, I think, reversing the power relationship, the Anglo-American relationship of the novels.
Now, the first Fleming novel appears in 1953, Dr. No, the first big-screen movie in 1962. How are the first Bond movies different from Fleming's conception of Bond?
I would have to qualify that by saying that the early movies are the closest to Fleming's stories of all the films. But nevertheless, there are some very significant differences. Stylistically, the films do, I think, modify the character of Bond by giving him a sense of humour, which is not really apparent in Fleming's books. But in the films, they introduce the sort of little one-liners, the sort of cynical asides, which is apparently something which Sean Connery and the director Terence Young worked together and themselves. These sort of asides aren't always in the shooting script. So add a sense of humour, a sense of cynicism, and show that Bond wasn't necessarily taking everything that happened to him seriously. That was, I think, an important stylistic change. There was also a very significant ideological change in that Fleming's books written during the 1950s were very explicitly set in the Cold War. The villains were it was the Soviet Union and particularly an organization which Fleming christened SMERSH, Schmierspione, Death to Spies. Now, in the films, there's a definite process of, I guess you'd say, depoliticization. The films are detached from this, from the coordinates of the Cold War. So that instead of, whereas the book of Dr. No had Fleming, Fleming's Dr. No was backed by the Soviet Union, in the film he becomes an agent of Spectre, the special executive for counterintelligence, terrorism, revenge and extortion. It's a sort of non-ideological international political organization, which is sort of committed to world domination, to blackmail and extortion, but isn't necessarily politically driven in the same way as the conspiracies had been in the books. That was a very important ideological shift. Quite why that was the case is very difficult to put one's finger on, but I think the producers were hoping that these films would be successful internationally, and that perhaps by downplaying the political nature of the conspiracies and sort of introducing villains who were threatening the whole world rather than acting necessarily solely against the West was a way of bringing about this depoliticization of the content.
You say in your book that the cinematic Bond was a product of the social and political conditions of the 1960s. How is that so?
Bond, I think, does very much sort of capture the spirit of the age, the zeitgeist, the mood of the times, in all sorts of ways. You couldn't have made the Bond films even a few years earlier, say in the late 50s. Bond is very much sort of coming on the cusp of the advent of the permissive society, of increasing, I suppose, liberalization in the depiction of sexual relationships and so on. Bond is an out-and-out hedonist who has lots of very glamorous girlfriends and so on. He enjoys, obviously, a very, very active sex life. This is sort of things that he's sort of, I think, responding to social changes which are taking place in Britain, in Western Europe, in the United States as well, in the 1960s. There's also, in the Bond films, I think, this very 60s obsession with colourful fantasy. Certainly if we compare the Bond films in terms of British cinema to the 1950s, well, the 1950s are often characterised as a kind of drab, dull decade, when the most successful British film of the 1950s, in comparison, was The Dambusters, a British war movie, very much in the sober, realistic documentary tradition. The 60s is all about colour, about fantasy, about visual excess. And the Bond films, I think, really sort of are part of that movement.
Is Bond mania related in any way to Beatlemania, which occurs at about the same time?
It is, yes. There's this phrase which is used of the British invasion of the United States, meaning that British popular culture, preeminently in pop music, especially the Beatles, acquires a new popular prestige and influence in the mid-60s. And it can actually be I think, identified quite explicitly in 1964 when the Beatles first visited the United States, and there's sort of your mass hysteria. They're very, very warmly received and so on. Beatlemania, the first half of 1964. At the end of 64, you get an outbreak of Bond mania in the United States. It's often overlooked these days. The first two Bond movies, Dr. No and Monsieur with Love, didn't do spectacularly well in America. They did very well in Europe. But they, in America, they were sort of released in the bottom half of double bills. They did reasonable box office, but nothing very special. It was with Goldfinger that was released in the States in December 1964 that Bond mania really took off. United Artists, who were the distributors, really got behind the film, promoted it in ways which we now take for granted with blockbusters, with lots of heavy advertising campaigns, lots of prints of the films being made, sort of saturation advertising and so on. I think one of the reasons why the film is very successful is that Goldfinger is set almost entirely in the United States, and the threat to detonate an atomic bomb inside Fort Knox is directed very much against American interests. So Bond is acting almost as a kind of surrogate American hero in that respect. And that's the film which really marks the takeoff of Bond mania as a cultural phenomenon, as something of being more than just about the movies themselves, but permeating into popular culture in a wider sense. So you get the soundtrack LP selling, you get the Goldfinger single recorded by Shirley Bassey going to the top of the charts and so on. Sort of Bond mania permeating into popular culture, into other forms of cultural expression.
Bond makes it big in the 60s, but of course he doesn't stay there. One of the themes of your book is how Bond has always been in danger of being out of date. You note at one point that even at the start he was in some ways anachronistic, and yet he always seems to land on his feet again. He's in danger of being out of date and yet always in transition. How has he changed from 1964 through the 70s, 80s, and 90s?
This is an interesting question because critics at various stages in the history of the Bond movie series have written the films off and said, well, these are old hats, they're tired, reworking old, overworked conventions, and there's nothing new to offer. I think the Bond producers have actually very cannily repositioned Bond quite continuously. There's been this continuous process of renewal. So Bond, although the films have been going on for nearly 40 years now, Bond has always remained a contemporary figure. So even as the world around him changes, Bond's age remains roughly the same and so on. And they always keep the films in terms of the technology and so on, and the gadgets which Bond uses and which the villains use. They always keep them just slightly ahead of the times. So, for example, the U.S. space shuttle first flew in 1981, but James Bond had actually been in the space shuttle in 1979. In Moonraker. So the films are just that little bit ahead on the cutting edge of technology. They've also quite cannily responded to social and geopolitical changes, so that in the 1980s, for example, when Margaret Thatcher's in power in Britain, the presidency of Ronald Reagan in the United States, and in the foreign policy rhetoric, you get a more pronounced return to certain Cold War paradigms. The Bond films address that and return to Cold War plots in the 1980s, which they actually abandoned in the 60s and 70s. So you get this constant process of renewal, of responding to change. In the 1990s, the Pierce Brosnan films have, again, responded to the end of the Cold War. In GoldenEye, made in 1995, Bond travels to Russia, but to the post-communist Russia, where his enemies are the newly powerful emergent Russian mafia and so on. So there's this constant process of keeping the conspiracies, the plots up to date, whilst maintaining Bond as a sort of character of roughly the same age.
So it seems James Bond, though 40 years on screen, is not likely to come in from the cold anytime soon.
I don't think so. I think as long as there's an audience there for the movies, they'll go on making the films.
Well, thank you for speaking with us today, Dr. Chapman.
That's quite all right. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to James Chapman, author of License to Thrill, A Cultural History of the James Bond Films.
Thank you, Fred. And moving from London to Washington, we continue on our theme of spies and recommend to you a tour of spy sites in the nation's capital. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Spies of Washington Tours, offered to the Cold War Museum, is a half-day excursion in Washington, D.C., the scene of international intrigue, espionage, and intelligence activity. The bus tour will introduce you to many of the locations in and around Washington associated with intelligence and counterintelligence activities for the past 200 years, including drop points like the mailbox used by Aldrich Ames to contact Soviet handlers, the homes of the famous spies, Ames, Aldrich Hiss, and Major General Wild Bill Donovan, among others, are also on the tour. You can book your tickets online at the Cold War Museum website. Tickets are $45 per person, and group rates are available. Contact the Cold War Museum for more information.
The recent election in Mexico, as the result of which, for the first time in 80 years, one political party was replaced by another, peacefully, reminds historian James Banner of a similar election that occurred in American history 200 years ago. Banner, who lives in Washington, D.C., is an independent historian. He's the co-founder and co-director of the History News Service.
On December 1st last year, for the first time since Mexico's modern revolution in the 1920s, one party, the National Action Party, or PAN, replaced another, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, which had ruled Mexico for 7 decades, at the helm of state. The transition took place peacefully, and as a result of the most open and democratic election in Mexico's history. Americans take such transitions for granted ever since 200 years ago. The U.S. passed its own acid test of constitutional government when Thomas Jefferson's Democratic Republican Party peacefully replaced John Adams's Federalist Party. And they do so even in moments of confusion like those that followed last fall's election. What made that distant election of 1800 so epochal was that it was the first peaceful transition between political parties in recorded history. Unlike Mexico today, the U.S. was the world's first constitutional republic. And unlike Mexico's almost 80-year-old constitution, the American Constitution was only 12 years of age when put to the transition test. As a result, no one knew whether the infant American constitutional regime could survive the substitution of one party by another. 2 terms of George Washington's presidency, then one of Adams's, seemed to give their Federalist Party a permanent claim on the government, and most Federalists thought that their party deserved to possess the presidency indefinitely. Like Mexico's Vicente Fox, Jefferson, James Madison, and others vigorously challenged Federalist policies and worked to throw the Federalists from office. Narrowly succeeding in doing so, neither they nor anyone else had full confidence that their opponents would give way peacefully. After all, never before in the world had a constitutional republic existed. Therefore, never before in world history had such a transition between political parties occurred. As it turned out, despite rumors of armed conflict and last-minute Federalist efforts to prevent Jefferson's inauguration as third president, the epoch-making transfer of authority from one party to another took place. The Federalists were out. The Democratic Republicans were in, the Constitution ruled. Since then, in a gradually increasing number of constitutional republics and monarchies, parties have routinely and peacefully replaced others. Mexico has now joined their ranks. Fortunately, unlike the U.S. 200 years ago, Mexicans have had little reason to worry that their own first similar transition would not be peaceable. Their Constitution remains unviolated. As a result, no doubt the day will soon come when parties in Mexico, like those in the U.S., vie routinely with each other in cities, states, and nation, and then step into each other's shoes without citizens losing too much sleep. When that happens, opposition politics in Mexico will have become, as in the U.S., a normal part of constitutional government. Americans have every reason to applaud this moment in Mexico's history, not simply for what it means for our southern neighbor, but for its echoes of a similar moment in American history. That moment, 200 years ago, marked a turning point in world history.
You've been listening to James Danner. His op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And this is Talking History. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, the Phoenix Art Museum is offering the first comprehensive exhibition of the art of Norman Rockwell, exploring his unparalleled role as an American icon maker and storyteller. Norman Rockwell, Pictures for the American People, opens on January 27th and will be on view until May 6, 2001. The exhibit demonstrates how Rockwell's images provided Americans with vocabulary for describing and celebrating themselves, their country, and their experiences in the 20th century. It also illuminates the relationships between Rockwell and the magazines and advertisers for whom he worked and how they influenced his subject matter. Viewers will find the sentimental and humorous pictures for which Rockwell is best known, as well as his more critical images of life in America, like The Problem We All Live With, a commentary on racism and segregation. For more information on Norman Rockwell, Pictures for the American People, contact the Phoenix Art Museum. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look back at the struggle between the West and the Soviet Union, known as the Cold War. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.